I need to hang on. I need to change something on my computer. I'm not a natural Mac user.
Oh no, you're on an unexpected Mac.
The unexpected Mac. It's always the worst kind of Mac.
Hello, and welcome to Unfinishing, the podcast about things that are incomplete, abandoned, or not public. My name's Emily Anderson, and my guest in this episode is Nathan Waddell. Nathan is a lecturer at the University of Birmingham, where he works in the English Literature Department. He's got interests in George Orwell, in the modernist painter and writer Wyndham Lewis, and in many other aspects of early 20th century and interwar culture. Alongside that, and mostly outside of work, Nathan is also an extremely keen pianist. And actually, he admitted that he spends more time playing the piano than he does reading. That's a subject for a future conversation, though, because in this episode, we talked about a mixture of unfinished things in relation to George Orwell, the writer who's best known for his novels 1984 and Animal Farm. Nathan talks me through some stories that Orwell left unfinished when he died in 1950. We then go on to talk about Half-Life, an unfinished video game with Orwellian themes. And finally, Nathan tells me about his unfinished podcast, which began as a chapter-by-chapter commentary on 1984. Before we get to the interview, all that remains for me to say is that if you have an unfinished, abandoned, or private project that you'd like to talk about, you can get in touch via email on unfinishing.pod@gmail.com, or I'm on Instagram at unfinishingpod, or Twitter at truebagglerag. Okay, so we're here to talk about various different aspects of unfinishedness and Orwell and in Orwell's work, but I wondered if first we could go through a little bit of an introduction to Orwell for people who maybe have heard of him but haven't read his stuff. So who was he and what did he write? Why should we care about what he wrote?
So Orwell's one of those people who's sort of known with a capital K, but not really known with a lowercase k. Most of the things that people know about him are sort of legends and myths, in the sense that these things have sort of grown and developed and sort of had a life of their own around him. One of the most important, although it's not a myth, is the fact that his name is not actually George Orwell, it's Eric Blair. He was born Eric Blair, 1903, and he lived until 1950, and he died of that familiar artist's disease, tuberculosis. He was born in British India, and his father, Richard, worked in the opium department in the Indian civil service. His mother, Ida, though born in England, grew up in Burma, which was important for Orwell, sort of a bit later on. In England, he went through a series of private schools, culminating in Eton, where he went as a King's Scholar, and that was in the late 19-teens. So he goes there in 1917 and leaves in 1921. And after Eton, he goes to British Burma, as it then was, to work in the Indian Imperial Police Force. And he spends 5 years there doing that, which is in some ways a sort of unexpected thing for somebody in his position to have done. The more traditional, typical, or predictable career choice would have been university at that point. But he doesn't do that, and he sets up this sort of pattern of odd behavior, which follows him through his life. He's always, not exactly a refusenik, but he's certainly one for taking the unexpected path.
And was he writing throughout that? So was he writing, for example, when he was in the police force?
Not that we know. Not with any great degree of sort of sizable output. His career as a writer gets going once he comes back, although he does write poems while he's in Burma, and they're all right. there's a reason that Orwell isn't really known as a poet. But in some ways that's a little unfair, because of course one of the things that he does with the poetry that he writes, or the poetic sort of skill that he develops, is that he often assigns the ability, if that's the right word for it, to write bad poems to certain characters. His protagonist, Gordon Comstock, in the novel Keep the Aspidistra Flying, is a terrible poet. But of course, you've got to be quite a good poet to write convincingly bad, sort of thematically legitimately bad poetry. So there's a sort of positive in the negative. But he goes to Burma and spends that sort of half decade there, and then decides to come back to throw that all in. He becomes increasingly disillusioned with the imperial project, and on his return to England, he decides to, as he sort of puts it, to go down and out, which means he wanted to spend time with the people who were forgotten by society, the people who were living on streets, the people who were in extremely underpaid forms of employment, so sort of dishwashers and maids and servants, you know, in the sort of cheapest hotels, that kind of thing. And he investigates some of that in London, and he investigates some of it in Paris as well. And this leads to the book that he calls Down and Out in Paris and London, which he publishes in 1933. And that's the point when he publishes that book at which he adopts the pen name George Orwell. And there's a funny sort of forking of the roads at that point, because he has other choices for a pseudonym. He'd used the pseudonym P.S. Burton for some of his so-called tramping expeditions, but he also considered the, in some ways, highly unpromising pseudonyms Kenneth Miles and H. Lewis Always, neither of which necessarily have the ring of posterity to them, but he settles on George Orwell. He says, I rather like George Orwell. And, you know, there it was.
Lovely. And can I just ask about that decision to go down and out, as he put it? Do we have any evidence for where he got that idea from, what his motivation was for doing that?
So we have retrospective evidence as opposed to evidence in the moment. More of it is retrospective than sort of the 1920s. And it comes really, the justification in his book, The Road to Wigan Pier, which was published in 1937, so sort of a decade after he actually leaves. And there he says that he wanted to sort of experience power at the other end of the hierarchy. He'd been the agent, the instrument of empire, and he wanted to see things from the other end and to sort of immerse himself in the, you know, being the object of power rather than the subject of power. And he says that there was some sentiment and some romance in that choice. And I think in the abandoning of one form of hierarchy, he quickly discovers that hierarchies exist wherever you find yourself. And one of the things that Down and Out in Paris and London and many of his other books are very good at showing is that no matter where you are in the sort of what Orwell might have thought of as the class pyramid, there's always a hierarchy. There's always a top dog and underdog and a struggle between them. Yeah. And so you can't just escape from power, but you can find it manifesting in different ways in different contexts.
And would you say that kind of analysis and investigation of hierarchy and power is something that runs throughout his work as a whole?
Yes, very much so. And most powerfully and famously in the books for which he's most well known, Animal Farm and 1984. And there is a line, a sort of conceptual line and a political and biographical line from Burma to Oceania to Manor Farm, the settings of those two books. In a way, although Orwell leaves Burma, Burma never leaves him. And he is always living in the mindset of someone whose political consciousness was formed in the crucible of the imperial, what he might have thought of as the frontier, the imperial frontier. And he brings with him both the insights of injustice that he sees, you know, up close and personal in the sort of brute implementation of power in Burma from the British, or the Europeans, as he calls them in his novel Burmese Days. But also sort of exports his own inattention to how he was also complicit in that. Although he, on the one hand, wants to investigate it, he also remains, I think, a little naively persuaded of the idea that he could sort of somehow atone for some of that through fiction, which is one of the things that he kind of wants to do. He wants to sort of atone for his involvement in it, but at the same time carries with him in the writing of books like Animal Farm and 1984, a great deal of racial prejudice, actually. His writing is very sort of racially inattentive at times, and racist often as well. And that's a sort of thorn in the side of anyone who's an enthusiast of Orwell. You have to sort of negotiate and navigate that.
So is this then a writer who has a strong sense of literature as something that can do something to affect change, although, as you say, kind of imperfectly and uncomfortably in his case.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And I think the clearest way in which that materializes in Orwell's career is the fact that he wasn't really a novelist. He was more of an essayist and a book reviewer and a political writer in those forms. And the essay for him is a crucible for thought. It's a space for reflection, but it's also a way of prompting people to respond and to generate conversation. I don't think he ever thought of the novel as a particularly politically active format, although it could function as a warning. And he definitely views 1984 as a warning.
It's interesting that I listened to a great podcast recently. I think it was a BBC podcast about the essay as a form. And I was just thinking the other day, wouldn't it be great if we could have more popularized essays?
I was just thinking about what you were saying. No, I mean, Orwell's essays are, you know, they're incredibly readable. And I think one of the things that takes a little while to appreciate with Orwell is the degree of artifice in the positive sense beneath the apparent simplicity of it all. So he's one of these people who wrote, you know, huge quantities of stuff, and some of it is quickly written and it shows. But at the same time, he very quickly refined his craft, and he has this uncanny ability to capture complex things very simply and persuasively, and in doing so often to sort of manipulate the course of your thinking in sometimes a quite underhand way. So what seems to be self-evident in the way he's describing it is in fact being constructed for you as you're reading his prose, and you sort of think, oh no, well, of course, you know, of course this is true. But once you reflect, you think, actually, well, he's actually making, he's establishing the terms of debate here.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, he's a wonderful case study for how what can seem like a conversational form is in fact sort of implicitly polemical and dictates in advance the terms of engagement, as it were, for whatever subject is under discussion. Essay scholars, you know, scholars of the essay form are probably, you know, if anybody of that ilk listens to this, will probably tear their hair out at all of that. But he's got a very canny knack for making the large and big seem small and immediate.
One final question just on this background on Orwell. Can I ask, do you remember how you first encountered Orwell or how you became interested in him?
So I had the quite familiar point of entry into his work, which was through school and being forced to read Animal Farm and then chasing up with my English teacher saying, you know, is there more? Mm. And what is it? You know, and he said, well, the next obvious port of call is 1984, and off you go. And yeah, it was that. And then my godmother did me a huge service and very kindly for a birthday. I forget how old I was. I must have been 14, maybe 15, 14, 15. She bought me what at that time was the most readily available collection of his nonfiction. It was a 4-volume essays, letters, and diaries, and you know, various other things, reviews, and I still have it. It's in this room as I'm speaking, right here on my shelf. And you know, I can't pretend to have understood a lot of it, but I remember feeling spoken to by someone who was deeply impressive. Mm. You know, this writer, this figure from the past, who seemed, as I say, to be able to capture things very efficiently and very quickly. And the other main thing about that set that still is the case is that it smelled fantastic. It had that sort of that bookish, that vanillary smell of old paper, and it still smells like that. So I remember sort of sitting with the books and kind of inhaling it and thinking that this is just a sensorially pleasurable thing to do, as well as an intellectually satisfying read.
Superb. What a lovely present.
You know, taking pleasure in the smell of a publication of Orwell's is highly appropriate, given that Orwell was sort of obsessed with scent and stench and stink, and most of his fiction is written through or prioritizes the sense of smell as the sort of main point of entry into the world. And this has been noticed, and John Sutherland, an emeritus professor at UCL, wrote a biography of Orwell called Orwell's Nose, a pathological biography, and it's a sort of run through his life using smell as the point of departure. So sort of serendipity again.
What a lovely idea for a approach to a biography. I like that.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Okay, so we're here to talk about various different things related to unfinishedness and Orwell. And we're going to start with two essays that you have highlighted that Orwell never wrote, but you said had plans to write. One of which I believe is on Evelyn Waugh and one on Joseph Conrad. Could you just say a little bit about what those essays are, what we know about them?
So the context for these essays is that Orwell, as I've already said, was a prolific essayist and wrote many different kinds of essays, some on political topics, some on sort of historically immediate subjects, you know, often during World War II. But he wrote a great deal of essays about literary figures. Some of his most famous ones would include the very long essay on Charles Dickens, for example. He wrote about Tolstoy, he wrote about Shakespeare, he wrote about Rudyard Kipling and many others. And he had been reading Evelyn Waugh and Joseph Conrad throughout his career towards the end of his life. So we're talking about sort of 1949-ish, which is very close to his death, which is early in 1950. He envisages these two essays, and he actually begins the war one, the Evelyn Waugh one, and okay. He writes probably, you know, 1,200 words of that, and then it just breaks off in the middle of the manuscript. Yeah. The Conrad one remains only a plan.
Okay.
But we know, because Orwell has some very useful sort of literary scrapbooks. In those scrapbooks, you can see, because he was recording it, what he was reading, and he was, or planning to read at any rate. And he was, you know, he had in mind, and was either doing or had in mind, a pretty thorough immersion in their work. So he was, you know, really taking it quite seriously. The Conrad essay, it's not quite clear what the form of it would have been, mm-hmm. but it would, I mean, this is me speculating, but it would presumably have sort of synthesized the lifelong interest in Conrad that Orwell had, not because it was written at the end of his life, because he doesn't know that it's the end of his life, although he probably suspects that it might be, but that just was Orwell's typical attitude to writing about literary figures. It was to provide a kind of synthetic, synoptic account of their significance from top to bottom or beginning to end. The Evelyn Waugh essay, the plan there, from what we can tell of the little that survives, and this is a quote actually, the argument was going to be that Waugh is about as good a novelist as one can be, i.e. as novelists go today, Orwell writes, while holding untenable opinions. So it's a good example of Orwell's intellectual generosity. He thoroughly disagrees for various reasons, many of them related to class and religion, but at the same time recognizes the skill and the aptitude, the competence and the importance of Waugh's writing, and is happy to acknowledge that and to consecrate it through the sort of essay that had he finished it, it would have been.
Am I right in thinking that he actually knew Evelyn Waugh as well?
Very fleetingly.
Yeah.
So when Orwell was in his many visits into and out of sort of hospitals and rest homes and sanatoria as his health was declining, on one of those occasions, Evelyn Waugh discovered that he was nearby in the Cotswolds and sort of paid him a visit. And this is one of those encounters that is tantalizing,
yeah.
You know, sort of two literary greats running into each other. And you know, and actually there's a book which is all about not that meeting, although it's in it. It's a book about Orwell and Waugh. And it's a sort of reconstruction of links and parallels between them. This is one of the areas, one of the sort of the growth areas of Orwell's scholarship, actually, which is looking at the figures that he had either intellectual connections to or biographical entanglements with, and then, you know, writing a book about them. There's a book about him and Evelyn Waugh. There's a book about him and Alex Comfort. There's a book about him and Winston Churchill, even. You know, it's sort of, you know, there's many different angles that one could take on this.
So you've spoken a little bit about the Evelyn Waugh essay and kind of what he was planning to say in that, or some of what he did say in that, if there was, I think you said that one was actually started. And you said that the Conrad one was just a plan. Is it possible to extrapolate at all based on that plan, what his thoughts on Conrad were? Or?
Yeah, plan is probably the wrong word, yeah. Because it's not even that really. Okay. It's a sort of collection of things. You could probably extrapolate in a different way, though, from the fact that Orwell is reading Conrad throughout his life and often refers to his work and comes back to it in different ways, and even reviews some of his work, I think. the novels, particularly Burmese Days, so Orwell's novel, Burmese Days, which is 1934, which is his sort of most obvious empire novel. It's set in Burma, as the title suggests, and it's got a protagonist who is very loosely based on Orwell himself. You know, he, like Orwell, he has a mustache and he's tall and gangly and he's old before his time and these sorts of things. But it is very clearly indebted to Conrad's long short story, Heart of Darkness, and shares many of the same hypercritical sort of imaginings of the imperial project, but without the same sense of foreboding and intensity of language. And pretentiousness is the wrong word, because Conrad was never pretentiousness, but he was portentous. And Orwell doesn't have portent in his writing, even if he has seriousness. So he was, Orwell's relationship with Conrad was one of influence and inheritance and legacy. And I imagine, as I say, given that Orwell was probably thinking that his time was limited, it might be a sort of stock take type essay where he would seek to consolidate what Conrad meant to him.
Yeah. And then on the war one, I'm intrigued by the opinions over which there were disagreement. Yes. You said class and religion, which is, you know, two small topics for us there.
Yeah.
What was the disagreement in the two writers?
Well, there are several. Mm-hmm. There's one amazing little remark. I've just opened up the volume in which it is, just to make sure I get the wording right. He says, for example, that war is the latest, perhaps the last, of a long line of English writers whose real driving force is a romantic belief in aristocracy. And even in that seemingly objective description of a writer, there's a kind of tincture of sarcasm. Mm. And he goes on to say, actually, Orwell, that the early novels, War's early novels, Decline and Fall and Vile Bodies, and he says considerable passages in nearly all the subsequent books. He says, he's got this wonderful phrase. He says, they are all tinged by the kind of innocent snobbishness that causes people to wait 24 hours on the pavement to get a good view of a royal wedding. and it's so sort of, I immediately know what he's talking about, but it's also quite breathtakingly dismissive. and this is part of the appeal of Orwell, actually. Yeah. He is unafraid to say what he thinks.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the essay, this is one of the things that makes the unfinishedness of this essay so tantalizing, is that he opens, I don't know, do you mind me reading out a reasonably long?
Absolutely not. Go for it. Yeah.
100 words. This is like the opening paragraph. And this in some ways encapsulates a great deal of what Orwell is about when it comes to questions of free speech and intellectual integrity. So he says, this is the opening of the essay as we have the fragment of it. Within the last few decades, so this is rumored to be written or sort of speculated to be April 1949, in countries like Britain or the United States, the literary intelligentsia has grown large enough to constitute a world in itself. One important result of this is that the opinions which a writer feels frightened of expressing are not those which are disapproved of by society as a whole. To a great extent, what is still loosely thought of as heterodoxy has become orthodoxy. It is nonsense to pretend, for instance, that at this date there is something daring and original in proclaiming yourself an anarchist, an atheist, a pacifist, etc. The daring thing, or at any rate the unfashionable thing, is to believe in God, or to approve of the capitalist system. And then he continues, he says, in 1895, when Oscar Wilde was jailed, it must have needed very considerable moral courage to defend homosexuality. That's Orwell's word. Today, it would need no courage at all. Today, the equivalent action would be, perhaps, to defend anti-Semitism. But this example that I have chosen immediately reminds one of something else, namely that one cannot judge the value of an opinion simply by the amount of courage that is required in holding it. There is still such a thing as truth and falsehood. It is possible to hold true beliefs for the wrong reasons, and though there may be no advance in human intelligence, the prevailing ideas of one age are sometimes demonstrably less silly than those of another. And you can take issue with the phrasing, and you know, in certain respects it's a bit insensitive, but the deeper point here is that Orwell is very clear-eyed in seeing how the courage to hold an opinion does not validate the opinion. You know, the courage isn't enough. It's the rightness, the truthness, the truthness. That's a terrible phrase, isn't it? The truth of the, or truthiness, maybe the truth of the idea is what counts more so than the conviction with which one holds it. And this, of course, is precisely one of the main insights of 1984, that conviction is meaningless if the idea is false.
Yeah. And it really ties in with what you were saying earlier about the way it's expressed is very simple and you go along with it and it's perfectly easy to follow, but it's expressing quite complicated ideas in a pretty digestible way. I also just like it that he used the word silly in a sort of almost humorous way right at the end there.
Yes. Yeah. Orwell and humor is, it's a difficult one. He can be funny. Mm. I would say that he's good at generating mirth rather than humor. So Orwell's someone who I smile a lot when I'm reading, but I can't really ever remember laughing out loud at anything that he wrote. Yeah. With the possible exception of one moment in Animal Farm when Napoleon the pig, it is said of him that he is dying, comrades, and the reason he's dying is because he's had too much to drink and they don't quite understand.
Yeah.
That's quite funny. But most of it, it's sort of mirth, a raised eyebrow, satisfying smirk.
Yeah. Okay, so then the next unfinished piece of writing that you've identified from Orwell was a story, again, that he was looking at just before he died, you said, which would have taken him back to colonial settings, which we've mentioned a few times already. Could you say a little bit about that unfinished story, how much of it exists, for example?
Yes. Again, not a huge amount. There's a sort of a plan and then a digested, concentrated working out of the various beats and kind of emphases in the story. He gave it a provisional title, A Smoking Room Story, and it was to be set in large part on a ship sailing from Colombo in Sri Lanka, going, if memory serves, to Africa. Mm. And I think the interest for Orwell lay in the sort of social vignette that being on one of those ships would have given to him and given to the observer. So in some respects, it was to be a study of, sort of different national types in the confined space of a passenger liner. Again, Orwell had sailed to Burma on a similar kind of vessel and returned from it as well. But he also had at the back of his mind in many different ways a memory of being read news reports over the breakfast table about the sinking of the Titanic when he was a young boy. And he says in an essay written much later that this left this huge impact on him. And if you trace through his work, there are often images of sinking ships and sort of ocean liners sinking. And he uses them as those images as the sort of markers of a doomed civilization. So it goes back to colonial settings in the sense that it goes back to a part of the world that he had experienced and worked in and sort of knew. But it's also going back to the means of transport and transit through those spaces, and also concentrating on a small representative slice of humanity, which is the same strategy he adopts in Burmese Days. So there was a kind of full circle element to it. There's also evidence that he had in mind another novel, which was to be set in 1945, but that's less clear what that would have been. But I mean, one of the things to take from all of these things, so not only from the Smoking Room story, the other novel, but also the Comrade and the Evelyn Waugh pieces, is that Orwell was still very much thinking that he had a future, even though he probably suspected that it was a pretty fragile one. And so when we assign culturally this immense status to 1984 as the sort of culmination of his thought, it's in some ways a bit misleading, because although it is a kind of work of consummation and culmination, it wasn't meant to be the last one.
Yeah.
History had other things in mind, but Orwell was definitely thinking beyond it. So that in itself is an interesting sign of how a completed novel, 1984, is part of an unfinished career.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's so interesting from the perspective of thinking about unfinished things, isn't it? Because it just goes to show that, well, unfinished things show us, I guess, that what is remembered and what does become famous and is kept is largely based on just by chance, right? What happened to have been completed, what happens to exist.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it's the sort of whims of unpredictability of fortune.
So let's talk now about the next element of Orwell and unfinishedness that we plan to, which is Orwell's influence on the Half-Life video game series, which you've said is perennially unfinished. So I have to confess to having asked a tame gamer who I know about this, because I know nothing about video games. And he said that there's been people kind of clamoring for a Half-Life 3 for a long time. And I wondered if that was where the unfinishedness of it lies.
Yes, this is one of the modern tragedies of video game culture. There was this series. It began with a game called Half-Life, which was released in the late 90s and was a sort of revolutionary game because of the way it seamlessly integrated cinematic production with an action game premise. And the premise of the game is that there's this physicist called Gordon Freeman who works in a secret mountain lab called Black Mesa, and an alien invasion occurs and you have to sort of fight your way out of it to survive. And that's, you know, basically the game. Yeah. And that game was very influential and very highly regarded. And then 5-6 years later, and this was when I was an undergraduate at university, Half-Life 2 appeared, and it continued the idea, but upped the ante in every respect. It was very cinematic. Again, very action-based, and the two were seamlessly integrated. But there was also this narrative element, which was much more developed than the first game. And it was the setting was a kind of totalitarian state in an imagined sort of Eastern Bloc city after humanity has been essentially conquered by this mysterious otherworldly invasion force called the Combine, who have just taken over Earth, basically. And the game's premise is that you've got to not liberate all of Earth, but you've got to sort of destabilize the ruling force of City 17, which is the setting. And the dictator figure is a guy called Wallace Breen, who appears on big screens. Telescreens, anyone? and he's a kind of big brother type figure. And the reason Orwell is relevant to this is, on the face of it, you know, there's no Orwell in sight. Mm. You know, you could quite happily play the game having never read or even heard of Orwell, and you'd still get a lot from it, and you wouldn't need that context at all. But there's a few things that are interesting, some almost impossibly uncanny, one of which is that Orwell at one point used a pseudonym, John Freeman, which is not the same as Gordon Freeman, but there's two Freemans. Mm. And when I discovered this, my eyes popped out of my head. I thought, you know, that's mad. In the game, if you pay, so Half-Life 2, I mean, if you pay attention, there's a character at one point called Winston. Mm-hmm. There's the big brother figure, there's telescreens. And the video game designers themselves, in a book that accompanied that game, a sort of How We Made It type book, documentary book, they often talk about trying to both use the ideas of Orwell, but also to sort of outmaneuver him through using a futuristic setting. So there's Orwell in the mix of the design of that game. Yeah. And Half-Life 2 had some what are called expansion packs. So they're sort of miniature follow-up games that moved the story along. They took, I don't know, 5 hours to play or something. Mm. And there were two of those. And it ended on this cliffhanger in, I want to say 2007, it might have been 2008, something like that. And then there was nothing for over a decade. Mm. Nothing at all. There were rumors, there was hints, there was a lot of kind of fan clamoring for Half-Life 3, just never appeared. And the creators of the game series, Valve, are very good at basically just saying, you know, we're not going to tell you we're working on something.
Right.
We may be, we may not. if it's being made, it will be ready when it's ready. Mm. And Half-Life 3 hasn't appeared, but a game that's sort of set in the same universe and acts as a prequel to Half-Life 2 appeared in, I want to say 2020, because it was during the COVID pandemic, the first stages of it. And that just appeared out of nowhere. It was just announced one day, and then all of a sudden it was available. although you could only play it if you had very advanced virtual reality software, right, and glasses and, you know, headsets and things. So it dangled the prospect of continuing the unfinished story through a prequel that most people couldn't play. So it was, again, a bit annoying in that respect. But it's the great unfinished narrative of 21st century gaming. And for somebody who kind of experienced the game as they were coming into adulthood, yeah, me and many other people, it's just one of those annoying itches that you can't scratch. Yeah. And I really want to know where it's going. And it's unlikely to be finished. And that's deeply irritating and kind of sad if you have invested in that world, as I have and other people have. So that's one of the consequences of unfinishedness, or possible consequences of unfinishedness, which is sadness.
Yeah, yeah. And we don't know why it's unfinished.
Well, as I say, they're very tight-lipped. Yeah. I think one of the reasons is practical and material, because Valve has this very intriguing anarchic production model where there's no top-down direction of any one project. Mm-hmm. People come together, and if it reaches critical mass, they make that game. So what appears to have happened is that there never has been enough of a critical mass to devote their energies to the making of Half-Life 3. Mm. And over time, people have come and gone, the personnel has changed, and the original configuration of people just aren't there anymore. However, there are signs, because of the release of this other game, which was called Half-Life Alyx. It was named after a character in Half-Life 2, and it was kind of her story, that there's clearly a lingering interest in it. And my suspicion is they are, in fact, making it. It's just that they don't feel under any pressure to make it within a particular time scale because they have a guaranteed audience.
Yeah.
I have a very close friend of mine, and I have a continuing argument over whether they are or are, in fact, not making it. and I said to him, for a decade, they clearly will, because it will make loads of money and they don't have to do any work to get a new audience. And he said, I'll believe it when I see it. And then all of a sudden, Half-Life Alyx appeared, and voila, you know. So I have faith, but it may take a while for that faith to be fulfilled.
Yeah. And you said there that one of the consequences of things being unfinished is that it can be sad. There is a huge emotional impact of a story in particular that fans, readers, game players have invested in not being completed. And that kind of made me think about, you know, these examples of when something hasn't been finished. I'm thinking of like George R. R. Martin and Game of Thrones, and the fans kind of having a sense that they're sort of owed an ending there. Where do you stand on that? Do creators, do you think, have almost a duty to try and finish things in a satisfying way, or just finishing them at all for the sake of the fans?
I did when I was younger. I don't anymore. Okay. I don't think creators owe anyone anything. Yeah. And therein lies the tricky relationship with an audience. The audience, as you say, often feels like, you know, they've given you money, they've invested their time and emotion in your product, if you want to put it sort of commercially, or your world, if you want to put it a bit more imaginatively. But the creator is under no obligation to finish. And in some ways, it may be better not to finish. Sometimes people say, you know, you should end something on a high. Mm. Sometimes that aligns with finishedness, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
But it may be better to just end on the high no matter what.
Yeah.
However annoying it might be for certain constituencies. But that might be the better option ultimately. But the problem is you don't have a full context for understanding that. If we were speaking 40 years ahead of where the game was not completed, then one would reasonably assume that it would never be finished.
Yeah.
You know, that was it.
Yeah.
But because we're still kind of in the foothills of their creativity, and because there has been these other little bumps of content that have come out, it's hard not to suspect that they are, in fact, finishing. It's just that the process of finishing is extended and can feel like unfinishedness, even if it isn't. So, but it's all unconfirmed. That's the other thing. You know, they're amazing at message discipline, Valve. They give nothing away. There's no leaks. There's no hinting. There's nothing at all. And it's just marvelous in some ways, you know, that they're able to do this, to keep it so secret.
For a sustained period as well. That's quite impressive.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, they must have some incredibly legally powerful non-disclosure agreements at work. I imagine it's that, at least partially. And then the rest of it, I think, is more, as soon as you announce something, you put yourself under a certain amount of pressure. That can be very beneficial. It's good sometimes to say that I'm doing something or you're doing something so that you feel the pressure of an outside witness to make you complete it. But at the same time, if you get 85% of the way into something and then you think, actually, what's needed now is a 2-year break, you know, that's, you know, in order for me to really digest and to think about how to get it to 100%, that's much harder to do if you've already announced that it's on its way, because then you disappoint people, you annoy them, and, you know, so it may be better to say nothing at all. And I think that is Valve's position. They would rather say nothing, confirm nothing or deny nothing, and then just one day say, here it is, and the world goes mad, then say, in 2 years' time, and then to have constantly to postpone it.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I feel as though the longer they leave it, the more pressure there is for it to be really good, and therefore probably the longer it takes to kind of perfect it.
Yes. Yeah. And the technology is changing all the time. What I think saves them from that problem is that their storytelling has been, and presumably will continue to be if they are in fact doing it, excellent.
Okay.
So it's all rooted in very solid storytelling mechanics. And the technology, the graphics technology and the physics engines and the gameplay that sort of surrounds it, in some ways it doesn't matter if it dates because the story is so good. As long as the story is there, that compensates for a great deal on the technological side.
Yeah. And you said it ended on a cliffhanger, and assuming that anyone who is going to play it has already played it, so we're not going to do any spoilers, can you say what the cliffhanger was?
So the cliffhanger was, so this is in Half-Life 2 Episode 2, which was the second of those expansion sets that I mentioned. You fight your way to a forest base, a kind of rebel base that's under attack. You fight off the attack, and you are in a conversation. It's a first person game, so you feel you're sort of in the game as you're playing it. You're talking to Alex, who is the character that the more recent game is based on, and her father, and these combine sort of alien overlord type flying worm type creatures. They're very strange. They break into the scene and kill him, and it ends there, and you sort of you're left in stasis as to what that means. Where's it gonna go? And it's just this moment of real, it's not only a cliffhanger, but it's emotionally fraught, because you've invested two main games and two smaller games in the arc of that group. It's all snatched away from you in an instant.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, and it's been like that for 20 years.
And I think hearing you talk about that brings home why it might be that scholars have started paying more attention to video games as an object of analysis. I wondered if you could talk me through a little bit about what's going on in that field at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I'm of limited expertise here. If I understand it correctly, a great deal of scholarship has been, video game scholarship has been concentrated on the phenomenology of video games. So, you know, what it's like to play them, what sort of worlds they allow the player to enter, what limits are there to those things, what possibilities. And then you've got maybe, again, you know, I'm not authoritative here, but a developing area of interest in the themes, as we might talk about a novel's themes or a film's themes or whatever, sort of being paid to that stuff. But of course, the problem is the opportunity as well as the problem is that those things are all connected. Mm. You know, the story of a video game is one that you must play through in the same way that you must read a novel. So you have to work through the game in order to experience the story. And of course, doing that entails a phenomenology and experience, a kind of sensory intellectual experience that's quite different from a novel, because the novel is defined in a way that a video game is still defined, but in a much more loose fashion. So, you know, the story of Half-Life is there, set in stone. It is always the same story, no matter who plays it. But the experience of it in the movement around the spaces that it takes place in and the sort of combat that you experience as you're going through them, that is always unique. So there's this sort of double movement. And, you know, I have it in mind at some point, and I have for 20 years, to write an essay about Orwell and Half-Life. I've not quite figured out how I would do it or whether I even want to, actually. And, you know, it's an unfinished objective. It's something that I maybe feel more comfortable just having there as an unfinished thing or as an unrealized thing.
Yeah. Do you mind me asking where that is?
It's more comforting to have it unfinished.
Mm.
I find that finished things are actually quite disappointing in the finishing. And also in academia, finished things disappear very quickly. By far the most dominant, or the dominant experience I've had of writing as a scholar, and this is one reason why I'm increasingly wanting to write for more general, so-called popular audiences, mm-hmm. is that you spend an immense amount of effort writing these highly intricate, very deeply researched, strength-sapping things, monographs, PhD theses, articles, whatever they might be. You finish them, they're peer-reviewed, you get a pat on the back and off they go, and they disappear basically without trace. Mm. Or even if they're read, they're not read with a particularly sizable constituency of readers. And the amount of input does not match the nature of the output or the reception. And so in some ways it's not only easier to leave it unfinished, but in some ways it's a bit more intellectually respectable to have it unfinished, because you're at least not sending it out into the void. It's still there to sort of structure your mind and to prompt different kinds of thought. And, you know, I occasionally, I don't know, once every few years, I open up the file that on my computer that's got all the Orwell Half-Life stuff in it, and I have a look through it, and I think, you know, I've changed my opinions about certain things over the years, and that's quite nice to see. But it's also just for me, and maybe I don't want to let go of that. You know, I've been speaking to you about it, and anyone who listens to this podcast will then know about it as well. But maybe that's enough. I mean, the podcast is itself a form of dissemination and a form of scholarly and other, you know, not only scholarly, but other forms of communication. And it maybe that's enough. And I don't mean that. I don't mean that as a kind of disappointment. You know, it's sort of the scholarly mindset that one has is always that, no, it must be an article, it must be a book, it must be an edited collection, it must be a conference paper, it must be these things. And there's a kind of ludicrousness to that. You know, why not a more ephemeral, immediate, meaningful, quotidian, everyday, conversational documentation of those things, like a podcast conversation?
Mm-hmm. I'm always looking for the different value that there is in unfinished things. And that's a really good summary of what leaving something unfinished can provide, I suppose.
Well, this is the nature of modern existence, isn't it? If you were to be very sort of, you know, serious and polemical about it, you would say that the drive to completion and to the moving on of something, to sort of the satisfying of that agenda so that you can move on to the next one, is part of what keeps the consumerist machine turning. But what you don't want in consumer society is things that linger because they're incomplete. And there's a sort of profoundly anti-status quo dimension to unfinishedness. It's very generative as a countervailing mode of being, I think. The drive is always to completion, to finishness, to perfection, to the rounded edge, as opposed to the pockmarked edge or the kind of destabilized edge. And those things, I mean, as I'm getting older, I'm increasingly fond of those things. I remember being told one of the best pieces of advice I was ever given as an academic was by a colleague I had at Nottingham, who, when I arrived there, I was quite fresh-faced and naive and a bit narcissistic in some ways, and I wanted always to be on top of things and for everything to be structured and ordered and rigidly defined and quick turnarounds and this, that, and the other. Structure. And she said to me, you know, there's a virtue in chaos, Nathan. And at the time, I didn't quite know what that meant, but I've come to accept it and to embrace it. And particularly since having children who are agents of chaos and you know, they disturb and they upset and they decompile and, you know, everything changes. But I think that aside, that there is a virtue in accepting the inevitable unfinishedness of things, because everything's unfinished ultimately.
Mm. Okay, so finally, I wanted to talk to you about your Orwell podcast, which you've said you suspect will remain unfinished. And it's a commentary on 1984. So could you just tell me a little bit about the podcast? How long have you been doing it? What does it consist of?
So I've been making it since 2020, and it's quite rough and ready. It's just me, occasionally with interviews, but often just me. And it began as and has remained a teaching aid. I give it to students to say, you know, if you want optional extra listening or reading or whatever, you can go to the podcast. And the first 10 or so episodes were or are a chapter by chapter read through of 1984. And my ambition at that point was to do the whole book. Until one day I realized how many chapters there are in 1984. There's something like 30 chapters. And each commentary was about, because I wrote them out so that I could put the text online as a sort of accessibility thing.
Sure.
But also because I wanted to be quite precise in what I was saying about them. So I felt a scripted way was a way to achieve that. It's 4,000 or so words per episode. So it's an extraordinary amount of writing, you know, that you're potentially setting up for yourself. And so yeah. I didn't even get to the end of part one of 1984. I think I stopped short of it by maybe two chapters. So it's sort of an unfinished run through of even the first part of 1984, let alone the full novel. It then moved into sort of thematic considerations of each of the novels and non-fictional works that I was teaching Orwell's work from. And in a sense, that sub element of it is complete in that there is a sort of mini course there of Orwell. I've also been doing interviews with fellow Orwell scholars, people who've edited his work or had some other response to his work. And I've also been doing kind of quick revision episodes where I, without a script, just sit down and sort of talk about. I did 1984 actually. I wanted to finish 1984 in a way. So I did three episodes, part one, part two, part three. And I just sort of spoke about it without any preparation, really, just to sort of get something down that might be useful for people who did want some overview of the whole thing. But strictly speaking, it's an unfinished response to 1984, but will also, I think, again, by definition, forever be unfinished in the sense that there will always be more to say about Orwell. And I will always have more to say.
Can I ask what the response has been? Did you get any feedback from your students? Did they like it?
Well, students are always very tight-lipped. So you'll send it to them and they'll either enthusiastically or dutifully listen to it, who knows? And then they might maybe one day slip a compliment in an unmeaning way in a sort of casual conversation. But having said that, more recently, as the podcast has grown a little bit, you know, it's up to like 20 episodes or something. There's a bit more substance to it now. So I think students are finding it a bit more useful. Certainly the ones I'm teaching currently have been saying, you know, this is actually quite helpful. And I envisaged it not only as a teaching guide, but also as a way to circumvent something that I don't like to do, which is when lecturing, I don't like to read lectures out from a script. I prefer to improvise around slides, but the cost of that is that you sacrifice exactitude, I think, at some level. What you gain is personability. You can connect with your audience in a more immediate way. You can move around the room if you want to a bit more easily. You know, there's many reasons to do it, but what you necessarily sacrifice is that word by word precision that you can get some of when you're improvising, but it's hard to be really, really kind of precise. Yeah. So of course the way to do it is to write it out. But I said to the first time I did it, I said, you know, I've got the lectures, we've got seminars, but if you want the kind of scripted version of these things, go to the podcast because that's where it is. And you can listen to it in your own time. You know, you don't have to listen to it in any particular sequence. It's up to you whether you listen to it at all. You know, you don't have to. I've actually had quite a good response from secondary school teachers, several of whom who have encountered it and used it. And I've given talks at schools on the basis of the connection that has brought about. Yeah. So it's had sort of unpredictable consequences in that way.
And I know that you said that you scripted it, but I was interested to hear about, do you find yourself structuring things or expressing things differently for the audio format than you would do in your academic writing, for example? Does it bring out anything different?
Well, it's kind of brought out the kind of writer I want to be, actually. When I started writing the podcast episodes, I realized that the kind of writing I most want to spend my time doing is not the kind of writing that would satisfy the expectations of the research excellence framework, for example, which, you know, if anyone doesn't know that, that's the regular sort of every 8 year or so assessment exercise that all universities go through to assess the quality of their research. And there are particular things that are submissible to that, academic books, academic essays, that kind of thing. And there's many different ways to write those things, but they have to have certain kinds of content in order to qualify. For as long as I'm an academic, however long that will be, I will be obliged at some level to continue writing those things, and I will do at least some of it very enthusiastically. But most of my time now I want to actually devote to the kind of informal, digressive, unplanned, but still sort of authoritative and in some ways expert working through of ideas in a given writer. I love patterns. I love finding patterns and sort of tracing patterns either within a text or across a career for its own sake. That's a very unref thing to be doing, because a ref submission always wants to know, well, what's the meaning? What's the purpose of this? Why are you doing this? It's not enough in that context to say, well, I'm doing it just because it's interesting. Whereas you can do that with a podcast, because there's no expectations of it. There's no demand made of it. You can just say, look, isn't this fascinating that Orwell is writing about pyramids in this book, and he's also writing about it over there? Why might that be? We could speculate. We don't have to prove it. Yeah. And so I'm finding myself writing more and more, or wanting to write more and more in that way. And necessarily it means cutting out jargon. It means cutting out unclear language. It means considering what the words might have to sound like as spoken language rather than read language. And it changes how you approach the subject matter, definitely. I mean, even just talking to you about it now is clarifying certain things for me. I don't want to sound too pretentious, but I think as a clarifying exercise, creating a podcast, however amateurish it might be, has been very useful for that, if nothing else, you know, to actually help me decide or to realize the kind of writing I'm most interested to do or to create.
I was just thinking as you're talking as well, like, and even just some of the things that you've been saying in this recording reminds me of the LRB podcast and the close reading stuff that they do, if you've come across that. Brilliant to listen to, I think.
Yes. Yeah, well, I was having a conversation today with a colleague about the fact that in some ways the most authentic version of scholarship that scholars, certainly university scholars, university-based scholars, enact or perform is conversation. And that does not translate into the traditional article or book. You know, it's a very sort of crafted, reasoned, sculpted, performed style of writing that goes into the article, the book. But we spend most of our time talking about literature or film or sculpture or whatever with students, with each other, with ourselves even. And it's very rare to have that translated into a permanent or even semi-permanent form. And I've just always wondered why we're so reluctant to leave things there. You know, the podcast as a form is obviously saturated, you know, it's everywhere, the podcast, but so are books. Books are everywhere as well. So I don't necessarily see that as a problem. It's a different way of thinking, a different way of capturing thought. And in many ways, I think a much better one. You know, it's more honest at some level. You can still perform an identity on a podcast, but certainly when I listen to two informed literary scholars talking in a relaxed way about a poem or a play or a novel, I find that much more engaging in many ways than reading what they have to say about it in their university press monograph, which feels like it's, I don't know, it's set in stone in a way that the conversation isn't and is more alive for not being set in stone.
I think that actually those moments that you have when you are struck, like particularly struck by a brilliant analysis and it's wonderful and exciting, I think those moments that I've had have been in conversation, in seminars. And it's such a skill when the person leading the seminar is able to bring that out, either by saying something themselves or by bringing it out from other people. And actually that can be the mind-blowing thing. And it's rarely that that moment happens reading an academic book, thinking about it.
Yeah, it's sort of necessarily ephemeral and needs to be. And it's the kind of observer's paradox. If you sought to capture it by recording it, you might change what's possible within the seminar format or the conversational format, of even if it's not a seminar. And so there's a good reason for it to be lost, even if it stays in the mind. You know, the sort of the moment passes, but the thought remains or lingers.
Hello, I'm just coming back at the end here to say a huge thank you to Nathan for what was an incredibly enjoyable conversation. I did at one point say in the unedited version that it was definitely the most interesting conversation I'd had on the day we recorded. But actually, I think it was probably the most interesting conversation I'd had for a considerably longer time than that. And it was a long conversation as well, so well done to those of you who made it right to the end. It is appreciated. If you want to find out more about George Orwell or his work, then frankly, I think you should go to the library and look it up. And then once you've done that, you can also, of course, listen to Nathan's podcast. I've put a link in the show notes to it.